Good evening and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm your host, coming to you through Zoom, Jeff Hayden. In recent shows, we focused on how we're all adjusting to a new normal. From pandemic to civil unrest, from re-examining how we go to work to re-examining race relations, or looking at how our children get to school, or even how this program is remote broadcasted. We've had a little time for discussion about other things in life, how the coronavirus has affected criminal law, for example. Certainly not from the perspectives of those who work within the justice system. Tonight, we're taking a fresh look at the very first thing addressed as someone enters the legal system, bail. And if time permits, perhaps the last experience one can have in the justice system, release. And in particular, the early releases that are occurring due to the pandemic. There's a lot to discuss. Our phone number here in the studio is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of San Francisco, call us toll free at 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. Bear in mind that our attorney guests cannot provide you precise legal advice as we don't have all the facts relating to a given case. But we are happy to pass along the legal principles to assist you in your decision-making. And then our phone number right here, 415-841-4134 or 866-798-8255. Joining us tonight, the deputy in charge of the South San Francisco branch of the San Mateo County District Attorney's Office, Aaron Fitzgerald, is a lifelong Bay Area resident who's been a prosecutor since 2001. Aaron, I think we've gone to trial about 8 to 10 times, you and I. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
A practicing attorney, Dean Johnson, is an Emmy-nominated legal analyst and commentator, both legal and political matters for entities including ABC News, NBC News, Al Jazeera. A former prosecutor, Mr. Johnson practices criminal defense and civil litigation in both state and federal courts and has been a guest and co-host many times on Your Legal Rights. Dean, welcome once
again. Hey, Jeff, great to be here again.
In January 1998, C. Jeff Stanley founded Bad Boys Bail Bonds with a mission to serve the community of San Jose by providing individuals in all stations of life, including low and moderate income families, an avenue to fulfill their Eighth Amendment right. Bad Boys Bail Bonds now has over 130 employees with 8 additional offices statewide. But Bad Boys, taking it a step beyond just bailing people out, has been actively educating the public about their constitutional rights. Jeff Stanley, welcome.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me. Exciting times.
All my guests. These are interesting times. And welcome to all of my guests. I had some sample questions to start the show, but somebody's got to jump on me. Let me turn it over to David from San Mateo. Wants to know about getting a bail refund. David from San Mateo, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, big hello to everyone. So I have a question for your guest tonight. So my good friend here was arrested several months ago, and I posted several hundred dollars with the bail bondsman to help get him out. Turns out the DA decided not to file formal charges. So my question is, since there's no formal charges, can I get a refund on the bail?
You know, before anybody answers that, that hits really, really closely to where we were going to start the show. And if you have a couple of minutes, David, what I'm going to ask is stay on the phone with us. I'm going to ask the first question to Jeff Stanley about what's bail and what happens when you, after you've been arrested and you post bail, and do you get your money back? I'd like you to stay on the line so you can follow up as you wish.
Okay.
Great, Jeff. Actually, bail comes from old English law. Back in the days when somebody was arrested and that individual had other obligations and they didn't want to stay in custody, a lot of times they would either pledge property or pledge collateral or a family member. So if Johnny wanted to get out of custody, his brother Billy would come in and set in his stead. Well, if he was sentenced, the brother would do the time if the brother didn't show up. And if it was a hanging, he would have been hung. So, but times have dramatically changed. And the way it works is if an individual has a warrant for their arrest or they've been charged with a crime, each county typically has a bail schedule. Now, there are some extenuating circumstances where a magistrate will go to a magistrate if it's a domestic violence case. But each county has their own set bail schedule. So if they're not in custody and they have a warrant for arrest, they can actually call our office. We can walk them through the process where they don't actually go into the jail. We can take them down, get them fingerprinted, and post the bond. But if they are in custody, like a majority of the cases, you'll see everybody's entitled to that one phone call. They'll make that phone call to their bondsman or their family members, and either we start the process from there. So typically what we require is a co-signer, somebody who's going to be a signer on that bond that's responsible. Now, what they're responsible for is that that defendant makes each and every one of his court dates when he's required to appear. Should he fail to appear, they will owe us the full bond amount plus any costs or expenses that might incur in returning that individual to the custody of the court. For that, we charge a percentage. It's anywhere from 10 to 6% is what we charge on our bonds. And there's certain qualifying rates of the individual's a union member or the individuals in the military or if they're referred by an attorney. There are different rates. But they pay that bond. And to answer your question, that premium is fully earned once that individual is released from custody. So no, there wouldn't be a refund on that. We're regulated by the Department of Insurance. What you're doing is you're buying an insurance policy. You want to guarantee, the state of California wants to guarantee that that individual is going to make it back to court. So as long as that individual goes, once they're released from custody and the what we do is have a co-signer come into our office. They sign almost like a credit. It is a credit application that they're signing for the obligation of the bond. We also have the defendant come in and also sign because we also want them responsible. So we have them sign for themselves also. And as long as they go to each and every one of their court dates and the case is dismissed, the obligation is done. If that individual fails to appear, we have roughly 180 days to either reinstate that bond where we tell the court we want to keep them out on bond. We give them a letter of reinstatement and they stay out on bond while they're going to court, or we put them back into custody. And that's what we try to do. We try to work with people. We give them a call, say, hey, look, you missed your court date. We want to get you back into court date, and we get it reinstated. Or we give a reassumption to an attorney. So we'll give them a letter saying, hey, we still want to keep this individual back out on bail, and that's fine. But if he doesn't show up, then we actually go out and locate that individual, and we make sure that he's brought back before the jurisdiction of the court and held responsible on his charges. To make a long story long.
what happens in a situation where the person gives you money to get them out of jail, but then the prosecution never files the case? Do they get that back, or is that a deposit?
We're seeing that happen more and more. Listen, 10, 20 years ago, we didn't see it as much. Now we're seeing it's very common where that's happening. DAs are electing not to they're electing not to prosecute. And with that, once that individual, like I say, once that individual has been released, that premium is fully earned and non-refundable once the individual has been released from the custody of the court. Now, again, sometimes the DA refiles, and we can normally apply that existing or the previous bond on the refiling.
And similarly, and Aaron, jump in and back me up if you think appropriate, but it's my understanding that in San Mateo County, by way of example, because this is happening throughout the state, all the courts are choosing what essential functions they're going to maintain during the pandemic. And one of those in San Mateo is not the arraignment calendar for misdemeanors. So many misdemeanor cases are backed up and waiting for the day when the court's more functional. And there's 2,000 cases or so in the hopper right now waiting for the court to pick them up. So don't take it for granted that if your case wasn't ready on time, that it may be over. It may not be over.
Jeff, I take your point, and it's well-founded. We've attempted to address this, our criminal justice partners in San Mateo County, during this pandemic by addressing, you know, what bail, if any, needs to be posted. There has been various orders from the California Supreme Courts that addresses whether bail should or should not be set and what the amount is. Some functions have been curtailed, but in San Mateo County, you know, the DA's office, we've been working since the inception of this pandemic. The courts have been functioning as best they can, and I know our presiding judge is working hard with the courts to provide as many services as safely as possible. So we are getting news, and we do have to react to the news on the ground. From a prosecutor's perspective, there's reasons sometimes why we may not file the case immediately. Somebody posts bail and the case isn't provable beyond a reasonable doubt to a unanimous jury, we're not just filing the case just in sort of court deadlines. So there's a whole variety of reasons. This COVID pandemic certainly is affecting court dates in many cases. There's a desire for the DA's office to make sure that we are charging justly and appropriately as necessary. So sometimes a bail that is posted, if charges aren't filed, they may get filed at a later point, and then bail often is applied. A bail that was posted can be applied prospectively on those cases.
David, did that answer your question?
It did. I would just like to clarify, though, is there any circumstance where I would be able to get a refund?
Yes. If that individual was put back into custody before the case was settled. If he was put back into custody, then you would have a right to a refund.
That is, if he was put back by the bondsman.
That is correct.
But if the court increased bail, that's not going to get the individual a refund.
No, that's not. But if they do increase the bail, typically we can add that on to the new charges and credit him on that bond.
David, my next question for you, as somebody who works within the system, as you do, if you would like to stay on the line and participate, you may. And Debbie, I hope you can hear me. If we get an additional caller, even if David stays on the line, you can put the caller through. David is also, I recognize the voice, also a legal professional who may have an interest in participating. So if you want to stay on the line, you can. We'll take additional callers as it comes up.
All right. Thank you, Jeff.
Let me turn it to Dean Johnson, who is our resident legal analyst. And tell us a little bit about the system of bail. It's evolved a lot since the days when when you would send in a family member, and in our lifetimes, in the last 40, 45 years, it's changed significantly. Would you like to tell us a little bit about the evolution of bail?
Oh, sure. Let me first say I'm a huge fan of bad boy bail bonds. I use them with my clients. They do a fantastic job. I've even had them send their bail agents down so fast that they got there before the police got there with my client. So my client never saw the inside of a jail cell. That being said, you know, Jeffrey said that times have changed since the days when Fred could sit down for Bill in the jail cell and serve his bail. Times have changed, but not that much. The way bail operates in California still, for the most part, is based on a bail schedule where it doesn't matter who you are, it doesn't matter what your background is, the only thing the court will look at is what crime you're charged with, and they'll set the bail accordingly, because that's what the bail schedule says. And in most cases, that's the way it works out. We are going through an evolution now that will change that, I think, radically. And it's just happened in the last few months, in the space of about a year and a half. And the first step in that was the California Court of Appeal looked at this bail schedule and said, you know what, this is not fair. If you have a Jeffrey Epstein who's got $10 billion in the bank, he gets a $5,000 bail, that's pocket change for him. If you get some poor guy off the street who has the same charge and gets $5,000 bail, that could be financially devastating. And as a matter of fact, he probably wouldn't make bail and would stay in custody. And the court noted that, you know, we have a problem of mass incarceration in not only in this state, but in this country, that about 70% of the people who are sitting in jail are sitting in jail awaiting trial because they, the phrase is, for want of bail. They were not able to make bail. So in a case called N. Ray Humphrey, the California Court of Appeals said, this is not fair. This violates due process and equal protection. It's not that it doesn't treat equal people equally. It treats different cases the same. And that shouldn't be the case. So the court questioned monetary bail. Another layer was added on top of this when the legislature responded and enacted laws that would provide for essentially non-monetary bail. That is, people like Jeffrey wouldn't be writing bail bonds anymore. There would be conditions on the release of people in custody. In most cases, in some cases, there would still be monetary bail, but in most cases, not. That was actually put on hold because there was a ballot proposition put on, which is not going to be decided until November, about whether we have the old bail system or the new bail system. That wasn't a big enough mess. The mess got even worse when the COVID epidemic broke out and the California Supreme Court came out and said, you know, all of that's on hold. We need to think about COVID and the dangers of being in jail and think about the interests of the people who are in custody, because jails and prisons are essentially super spreads. And we need to get people out of custody. We've seen juvenile facilities now, the juvenile halls cleared of everybody but violent offenders. We've seen hundreds and hundreds of offenders released on zero bail. Try to get your mind around the concept of zero bail. And it goes on and on. The governor has now said that he has a list of about 8,000 inmates, and that from that list, people will be released from custody. Query whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, because some of those people undoubtedly have been exposed to COVID, and now they're going to be out in public. So it's a mess, but it's a revolution. It's an evolution. Like many things in our institutions, COVID has actually accelerated an evolution that had already started. And where it goes now, we're not really sure. But of course, people like Aaron, who are on the front lines with the DA's office in San Mateo County and other counties, are going to have to deal with this. DA's defense, public defenders are developing programs to try to deal with this and try to make the bail system a little more fair. So that's kind of a lengthy summary, but the bottom line is this is a mess right now, and we're going to have to sort out that mess over the next few months.
I'd like to back up just a little bit. Once recent change in bail, not in the last couple of years, but maybe 45 years ago, with the passage 40 years ago, with the passage of Proposition 8 in California, Proposition 8 was a major criminal justice reform measure that touched almost every area that we worked with. It followed the verdict in the Dan White case that many from San Francisco are aware of. And one of the subjects of that proposition was bail. And under previous law, bail really looked at getting you to court. And that's still the primary function of bail. But it added another tier, which was that of public safety, so that if the judge and the prosecutor felt that the person is a danger to public safety, posting bail, being able to post bail enough to make sure they come to court isn't necessarily enough if they're recidivist, which means if they keep coming back and they do something that endangers persons or properties, they have some relief under that section to enter a higher bail. And then Humphreys looks from the opposite perspective. If the person's unfairly unable to make bail, they should be able to lower the bail, or should lower the bail. That really brings us to where we are now. And Aaron, I would like to hear your perspective as a prosecutor. The Supreme Court handed down some changes in the way that we were going to deal with stuff for the time being because of the pandemic, looking at an emergency bail schedule, zero releases and the like. What is your take from where you're sitting?
Well, there have been a few unintended, I guess, interesting issues that have been raised as a result of this pandemic with regards to bail and recidivism. So as a result of the pandemic that we've suffered, there was massive movement to trying to assess a safety of inmates, a safety of jail personnel, safety of law enforcement, and an emergency bail schedule was announced that provided for $0 bail for a number of various crimes. There were some exceptions in a list of those crimes where bail still was to be set, you know, violent, serious felony, and other crimes. But we had an opportunity based upon this pandemic to have a lot of inmates not getting processed through our county jail. And just anecdotally, right now, our jail is about a 25% capacity, approximately. So one of the questions that can be raised at this time is, what are we seeing as a result of zero bail? How that works, and it's hard to wrap your head around, but if a criminal case is filed and we wish to arrest an individual, certain crimes would have had $0 bail. And presently, for most offenses, it's now been raised to $250 bail is our new presumptive amount. So what we're trying to balance, and I think what the courts are trying to balance, and this is, we're in uncharted waters, is how are we able to get a judge or somebody to assess a particular case and determine whether or not bail is appropriate or not. San Mateo County last year grants, and this kind of dovetails nicely into kind of what I wanted to talk about. We received a grant from the Judicial Council, and we had a pilot program here in San Mateo County involving pretrial release of persons arrested for crimes that are unable to post bail. So scenario one presently in San Mateo County is, if you're arrested on an offense where bail needs to be set, you can post bail, you're given a court date. That's kind of corridor number one. If you're unable to post bail, there is a pretrial program that was initiated in January where the probation department essentially conducts an assessment. There is a form that asks a number of different questions, which includes a person's prior criminal history, if they have past failures to appear, history of drug abuse. Essentially, they're given a score between 0 and 14. And based upon that score, they either qualify or are disqualified from pretrial release. So we actually have a program that's been implemented in January, which is a little bit of a foreshadowing of what may be happening in November following the referendum. So what ends up happening is a judge has to, within, I believe it's 8 to 12 hours approximately, has to be able to conduct a review of a particular defendant's history and makes a recommendation to the judge and the probation department whether this person qualifies for release. And many people in our county who are assessed are released on pretrial diversion without bail being set. So we actually have this program that has been implemented, and it's something that is going to be looked at statewide on the referendum, and we can discuss that if you think that's appropriate.
Hey, Aaron, you know, I'm just dead curious, and we've talked about this on the show before. We're now seeing with COVID and with pretrial release programs, we're seeing more and more people being released from the jails, people who otherwise, who in the past would have been held on bail. On the other hand, with COVID, there are fewer opportunities to commit crimes. I mean, people, bars aren't open, so people aren't drinking and driving. Burglaries probably aren't happening because their people are staying home. Have you, in your daily experience, have you seen an uptick in crime, a drop in crime, or just no difference? How does this affect the bigger picture?
That's a great question. And I can speak anecdotally. I haven't run the numbers, you know, post-March when we went into our shelter in place. But one of my duties is to cases where defendants are arrested the night before and they show up on what's called the custody list. Those people that are booked into jails for DA charging. And we have a couple of days to make a filing decision. It's a little bit of a false picture because for a large period of time, the only people that were being booked into jails were certain qualifying offenders. So you do get a little bit of an inaccurate sample. But what I can say is there were certain crimes that appear to be more prevalent. Domestic violence, for example, just anecdotally, when I saw cases, it seemed that we had more domestic violence cases. In terms of, unfortunately and tragically, cases involving child endangerment or child abuse, I do recall seeing those cases, you know, frequently as well on our list. I don't have any hard numbers, but what I can say is that officers, because of the zero bail and how we are accepting inmates, they were still working because I was daily seeing the work they were doing. But in terms of the number of arrests that were taking place, I think the number of arrests went down. However, cases are still and have been getting referred to our office for review. They just come to our office, I believe, in a different way. So it's a little hard to compare apples to apples.
Sure. So it's kind of like the stock market. You know, stockbrokers are talking about at-home stocks like Amazon rising. It sounds like the at-home crimes are on the uptick as well, huh?
You know, like I said, those are cases that we would see more, but those were some of the fewer cases that were typically showing up as arrests. What I can say is that as things have opened up with the sheltering place, it's busier at the DA's office. Not that it wasn't busy before, but we are seeing there's more calendar, there's more court calendars, there's more more court activity as we are, you know, slowly, incrementally working to expand court services.
You know, Dean, I know you talk about whether or not we see an uptick in crime. I think I have seen it. And listen, when I talk about other counties, I'm not talking about specifically, you know, San Francisco, but all around California. We've seen a dramatic increase. And we've also seen, you can go into any of your next door or neighbors or any of your apps like that, and you can see crime is going on in every single neighborhood every single day. I mean, it's happening. And I think it is actually rampant. We're also seeing a lot of officers not taking individuals into custody because they know that those individuals are going to be OR'd, and a lot of them are just cited out in the field. I know even before Chief Justice took the action of the zero bail, just releasing people out on the street, and let me digress on that. They say nonviolent crimes. If you take a look at what a nonviolent crime is human trafficking is nonviolent. Assault on an officer is nonviolent. Arson is nonviolent.
Well, before we go any more, I mean, there are some exceptions to the Chief Justice's order, and it lists a lot of crimes that we wouldn't think of as being necessarily violent, including resisting or delaying the police, not covered by that order, even though it didn't necessarily involve violence. I don't mean to cut you off.
No.
I will pick up at this very moment when we come back, but we do need to break for just a moment. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. We'll be back right after this.
Mm-hmm. Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
Again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. Tonight we're talking about your right to bail. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of San Francisco, call us toll free at 866-798-8255. Again, you want us to pay the freight? 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic, bail, or any question relating to criminal law. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation. And what, as we broke, Jeff, you were just talking about the crime that's out there now. Some of that is because everyone's at home looking out their windows. So things that happen in the neighborhoods are likely to be observed in a way that they might not have been all the time. But I'll let you pick up where you left off.
And that might be so. But we are seeing it's evident. We're seeing more and more individuals that are being affected by crime. And I think some of it's because of the action of individuals not being held in custody. We know the recidivism rate is high for crime. And I know, listen, they talk about a mass incarceration in the United States, but the reason we have mass incarceration is because we're a free country. There's many countries that don't have an incarceration problem, but I don't think we want to live there. They're not allowed to protest. You can't speak your mind. You can't carry guns. You can't, you're very well controlled. And in the United States, we have freedom, and with that comes a cost and a price. But we've seen, and listen, look at what's happened in Brooklyn, or actually all throughout New York, where they've eradicated bail. They had an individual, and I'm inundated with emails every single day. I mean, seriously, hundreds of them within a week, showing individuals that have reoffended that have been released on their own recognizance without any bail, without any accountability. They're out child molesting, they're raping, burglary, assault, murder, everything. They had a case of an individual in Brooklyn, New York. He robbed a bank. So they released him on his own recognizance. Guess what he did again? He robbed a bank. You know what they did again? They released him on his own recognizance.
A host of reasons why.
I'm going to have to take exception to this. I mean, mass incarceration is a huge problem. The fact of the matter is we have something like five times more people incarcerated in the United States than they have in China. China is an authoritarian country that incarcerates people for even criticizing the government. They have over 1 billion people. We have 300 million. And it's also clear that the incarceration rates disproportionately affect people of color. People of color who are charged with the same crimes and have the same criminal background as people, as Caucasian people, are doing longer and longer times in prison. The problem here is not the people who can afford your services, Jeffrey. The problem is people who can't afford your services. 70% of the people who are sitting in jail are sitting in jail for want of bail. That is, they can't make bail. That's why we have a revolution in the bail system. That's why we're calling for non-monetary bail. Sure, there are anecdotal cases out there. You can point all day to people who have been released on their own recognizance and gone out and committed another crime. I mean, Fox News just lives on those kind of anecdotal reports. But the fact is, and I happen to know this because I spent the last couple of days writing a bail motion for someone who's in jail, charged falsely with child molesting, that all of those myths simply aren't true. I mean, people talk all the time. Prosecutors get up all the time and say, oh, this man is charged with a sex crime. He's going to reoffend if he gets out. The truth is, based on dozens of objective studies, that even sex offenders who are the worst recidivists, about 97 to 98% of all people who are charged with sex offenses don't reoffend, whether they're let out on bail or whether they're adjudicated, sentenced, and serve their sentence. So that's, you know, the anecdotes are cute, they're great, but they just don't reflect the overall picture. And by the way, just before the show, I was reading an article in the New York Times talking about how crime actually has dropped since COVID. Crime rate is at the lowest that it's ever been since 1960. And that's lower than what was already a low crime rate because we had a precipitous drop in the crime rate in 1991. And there are reasons why it happened in 1991, which we've gone into before and we can go into again. But I just don't think that's accurate. And to say that mass incarceration is not a problem, ask anybody who has been incarcerated, ask anybody who is a person of color who's been accused of a crime. Go take a look at the prisons, which are overcrowded. Take a look at our jails, which before COVID, our jails were full. We just built a new jail, and that was full. We're talking about building yet another jail. It's a problem.
I can jump in here with a couple of thoughts. Please. As a former sex crimes prosecutor, I had the honor and the challenge of prosecuting cases involving victims of sex crimes, including having small children have to come into court and testify. I would note that, you know, statistics, it's just as good as the data is. And if somebody is being sentenced to 104 years to life on a sex crimes case, their ability to commit a further offense is somewhat impaired. So in terms of the sentences of individuals for those sorts of crimes, that may have some sort of bearing on recidivism. But anyway, I realize there's ongoing debate as to what those numbers are, and we can discuss different numbers. And so I just wanted to add that. And in terms of the bail issue, this is exactly what we're going to be in November. And there's a referendum that is going to assess whether or not we're going to be eliminating cash bail as an option, or if we're going to be keeping our existing system. So in terms of looking at that particular issue, right now judges have discretion to look at individualized circumstances and decide whether or not bail is appropriate or not. And it's my understanding that one of the consequences of this referendum appears to it would remove any sort of specific dollar amount of being set, and either a person commits a crime is either going to be held in pretrial detention with no dollar value that they can post, or they're going to be out on pretrial release. So one of the issues that it's going to be facing voters is whether or not we want an all or nothing posture. I think I'd like to frame at least the referendum from that one perspective. Plus others.
Before anybody else jumps in, two things. The first is, I think it would be really helpful to explain that in California, people that are serving longer sentences for serious crimes are in the prison systems. The local jails are usually for either very short sentences or for pretrial release. So we're kind of getting off topic a bit when we're talking a bit of, generally about crime and punishment, as opposed to really talking about pretrial detention. And I think we've gotten a bit off topic. I'd kind of like it to circle back. Before we do, let me turn it to Paul from Oakland. Paul, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi there.
Hey, Paul.
You want me to get start? I'll start. So my wife works at a Montessori school in Orinda, and you know, she's dealing with parents that aren't, you know, wearing masks. They aren't observing social distancing in spite of signs saying, stay in your car, we'll bring your kids to you. She's dealing with parents or children of parents that are not essential workers. Basically, what I'm calling to say is, what legal recourse does a school teacher in Orinda have against a school that is flagrantly breaking the law regarding the pandemic and what kinds of, you know, parents and people should be bringing their kids in for daycare?
You know, that's an interesting question. It's a little outside of most of our field.
Okay, I'll call back.
Really, a question
night.
Of whether the governor.
No, don't go away. We actually did a whole show on that, which you can find on the on the KALW archives. Yeah, that's going to be an issue and an area of vigorous litigation by the civil lawyers. The liability of institutions, whether they be schools, whether they be offices, whatever, for inadequately protecting their employees from COVID is going to be an area of litigation that I think is going to be unprecedentedly, if that's a word, large. And there are probably going to be a lot of lawyers who are going to make a lot of money off of that. I hope that
I momentarily forgot that Dean Johnson, my guest, has a civil litigation practice as well as his criminal practice. It's a bit off topic of the criminal side, because at this time, unless a local entity has put teeth behind it, there's neither enforcement nor real penalties behind the ideas of violating the pandemic, particularly in terms of mask wearing or essential workers. But that, as Dean pointed out, is not going to be a limit to civil litigation, and that may be where your remedy lies. She may have the right to an injunction, which may be her next step, if the courts will entertain it at this point, because the courts are being somewhat held back as well. Anybody else have any additional feedback? I know that Jeffrey's no longer on the phone, but he can be taking the answer on the air if anybody else has anything else they want to add to that. Seeing no volunteers, I'll jump in a little further. When we left off, we were talking a little bit about crime and punishment rather than the issue of bail. But bail does tie into it in a couple of ways in what's going on now, and I want to circle back to this point. Unlike prison, where people tend to stay for a long time, jail tends to be very short-lived and has a much stronger connection to the local communities. So the order to empty the jails wasn't so much an act of mercy to people inside. It's that these overcrowded jails had to have the population reduced in order to do some type of social distancing, lest they become a giant incubator in order for people to come in, get the virus, come back out, and spread it to the rest of us, which is where we were heading. I'd like to get different perspectives on that. Who wants to jump in? Aaron, you're more than welcome to jump in, but you're muted.
You're back. You can jump in when you can hear me. So in terms of the jail, I know that the jail has been taking extensive measures to ensure safety of not only the inmates that are being housed in the jail, along with the jail staff and law enforcement personnel who are responsible for transporting those inmates from local police agencies and also jail personnel. So there's been a number of steps taken to ensure the well-being of everybody. And I think that the sheriff's office work has been laudatory. They are separating inmates. There's a quarantine process in place if there's potential exposure. There is the social distancing that is being encouraged. You have to realize that our essential workers are exposing themselves literally and figuratively to disease and danger by going in each and every day into the jail. And there's also a desire to want to keep inmates healthy as well. And we've seen in the news, when that isn't done well, the consequences of that. So just in speaking with jail personnel and seeing how it's operating and at our present jail capacity, I do think San Mateo County has done a nice job in that regard.
Yeah, I don't disagree with anything that Aaron says. The way I like to look at it and the way I've argued it is that the California Constitution says that the accused has the right to reasonable bail. And all us lawyers know that when somebody says reasonable, that's kind of a code word for look at all the surrounding circumstances and do something of a cost-benefit analysis. And the factor that has to be added now in that reasonable bail analysis is the danger of incarceration to the defendant. And as Aaron points out, the danger to third parties, jail personnel, arresting officers, the custodial staff, and the people who are affected when the accused gets out, as he or she inevitably will. So I think we're looking at a new and different analysis. I've used it in court a couple of times with some success to say that in addition to flight risk and risk to the public, we also have to take into account the risk to the accused, the risk to the jail staff, and the risk to third parties. And I think that's where the law is going on this.
Jeff, if I could say, I said we got to be really careful. I know that a lot of counties have adopted a risk assessment tool. The Arnold Foundation already deemed that that is racially discriminative. And that is something that we got to really watch. Listen, I underwrite these bonds, individuals being released all day long. I've been doing it for over 20 years. I'm closer to 30 some odd years. But you take a look at, and listen, I know you say it's unfair. Crime is committed not because you are a minority. Crime is not committed because you are poor. And you have to be very careful when you have an individual, a single mother that's raising three kids. She has two jobs. She lives next door to a guy that's involved in a burglary. And there's no accountability. And you release them back out on the street without any accountability. Because we know that individuals released out on bail have a less likely chance of committing an offense while they're out on bail, opposed to pre-trial release. And it's actually double. So there's a couple of reasons behind that. But if you take a look at individuals that are in custody that can't afford bail, it's 5% of the jail population. That's a very...
Oh, that's not true. That's simply not accurate. It's 70%.
No.
70% of the population.
No, it's not.
Crime is not committed because you're poor or because you're a member of a certain race. Arrests are committed because you're poor or because you're a member of a certain race. Black and Hispanic young men are 10 times more likely to be arrested than people who don't fit that demographic. They're much less likely to get bail. They're much more likely to spend their entire pretrial period in custody. If all things are equal, their bail is set higher than a Caucasian.
So Dean, do you think they're just...
Wait. I let you talk. The likelihood of them staying in custody is something like 10 times higher, primarily because the net worth of a black family in America is approximately 10% of the net worth of the average white family. So monetary bail is devastating to people of color and to their families. That's why they often don't make bail. And a lot of these people are, and what happens is, as we know, pretrial detention then becomes de facto punishment. I've had clients who've spent a year in jail, 2 years in jail, 5 years in jail, awaiting trial simply because they couldn't make bail.
But listen, I know the figures. It's 5% of individuals that are in custody cannot afford bail. It's 5% of the jail population.
Your figures are wrong. Your figures are wrong. I looked those figures up 5 minutes before we came on the air.
Listen, we've done the
study. The figures are incorrect. 70% of the people who are in custody in jail awaiting trial are in custody because they can't make bail.
Yeah, but that's 70% awaiting trial.
Yeah, that's 70% of people who would otherwise be eligible for bail and they can't make it because they can't afford it.
There's a large segment that are released. Listen, I know this. This is my business.
This is my business, too, and I've been doing this for 32 years.
I'm a little longer, but that's okay.
Let me jump in for a minute. It's everybody's business, but Aaron, I'm looking at you, and you've been shut out of the conversation. Do you want to jump in at this point?
Please, Aaron, jump into the conversation.
To listen to a good argument between the parties, risking injecting myself. And what I can tell you is I'm not a sociologist, and this is kind of beyond, and these are profound societal issues in terms of when we're dealing with race and incarceration. And there's a huge debate, as you can see, in a movement that's happening across the nation. What I can tell you is that we at the DA's office are doing the best we can to review the individualized facts of a case. Our duty is to do justice. That sometimes requires us to file criminal charges. Justice also is dismissing cases and charges when they can't be proven beyond a reasonable doubt to 12 out of 12 jurors. So I'm confident that when our office is reviewing cases, we take our jobs seriously and professionally. I'm trying to make sometimes with facts and circumstances that are challenging to be able to ascertain. I don't think we're going to be able to solve all the statistics issues tonight, but I think it's been a very kind of productive discussion that we've been having.
Before things heat up again, I want to turn it to another caller, William from Belvedere. Welcome to Your Legal Rights. Our time is tight, but I didn't want to pass you on. William, you're on the air.
I'll be quick. I was struck by surprise, stunned by the gentleman who said that we have more people incarcerated because we have freedom. Gee whiz, I didn't know that Norway, Sweden, France, Germany, etc., I didn't know they were dictatorships. But is he saying that they're dictatorships because they don't have so many people? That could be the only explanation for why they don't have so many people incarcerated? I don't think that's what he's talking about.
I believe we have more freedoms here in the United States than anywhere in the world. I do a tremendous amount of traveling, and I've seen these places. You take a look at your gun rights and other interests. We have more freedoms than you do anywhere in the world.
Nations, dictatorships. When I have been there very often and see demonstrations all the time, and they're permitted all the time, I have to. What the trouble with you saying something that is, well, you'll excuse my saying it, nonsense, is that it weakens your position in other respects.
Well, one thing I don't think any of my guests can disagree with is at the present time, the United States, even with the pandemic, still has the highest incarceration rate of any place in the world. It looks like we lost William. Sorry, we got cut off. We are nearing the end of the hour, and I wanted to give everybody a couple minutes for any closing thoughts. We have about 6 minutes left. So why don't you each take about 2 minutes? Jeff, do you want to give any closing thoughts?
Fantastic. Hey, thank you very much. And I think this is great that we need to have these discussions. I appreciate Dean and his opinion. We need to have these discussions. I think there's a lot of things, and unfortunately, we don't have enough time. I think we could be on here for the next 20 hours. But I think there's things that we need to fix within the bail system and our judicial system. I think we have the best system in the world. There's not any other place that I would rather be. And again, I want to thank you gentlemen for this conversation.
And it's not always an easy conversation, and we're not always going to agree. But I think it's a spirited debate that I'm happy to have, and I'm glad that we're able to have that discussion. Which of you would like to go next, Dean or Aaron? I'm pointing at my Aaron. Screen that nobody can see.
Sure. So a couple of points I just wanted to leave our audience with. And the first point doesn't even have to do with bail. I just want to let you know, Jeff, that I had the honor and privilege of working with Chuck Finney, who was your predecessor at the DA's office, who handled this radio program year after year after year, dealing with legal issues that helped not only San Mateo County, but others. And I had an opportunity to work side by side with him and interact with him. So I thank you for carrying on his vocation that he gave a lot of the years of his life to, and allowing us to be here to talk about this issue of bail. In terms of bail, the voters are going to be asked to decide in November which direction the state of California is going to go with regards to cash bail. We presently have a system in California where there are a number of participants that are able to ensure justice in our cases. We have law enforcement investigating cases and submitting them, prosecutors throughout the state represented by counties and the attorney general's office that files charges. There are a seasoned defense counsel who advocate for their clients. We have judges having to make calls on such things as bail and incarceration. So there's a number of criminal justice partners that are all advocating and also helping with this system. And I can say, not to speak for America as a whole, but we do have a system where we have an opportunity to be able to discuss these items, to argue, to litigate as necessary, and ultimately to change where that change is necessary and required. It should be evidence-based, and ultimately as prosecutors, what I would like to leave our audience with is that the goal of a trial, the goal of the criminal justice system is to search for the truth. What is the truth? So when we attempt to do justice, justice sometimes requires charges to be filed, to receive justice for victims who have been harmed, either physically, sexually, or financially, or any other way, and then ultimately to receive appropriate sentencing for the suspects. Justice also may require defendants to be released from custody if their bail is excessive, and it may require ultimately the dismissal of their cases. There's much work to do, but I wouldn't be in any other system than the one that we have. I want to thank you all for the time.
David, you've been hanging on the line throughout the whole time we're here. I wanted to give you a chance for, before we close out and before I turn to Dean, I wanted to give you a minute or so if you wanted to say anything, if you want to jump in.
Yes, thank you, Jeff, for allowing me to tag along. This is a very important topic. Obviously, it can't be discussed in 55 minutes. I hope we can do this again sometime and sometime soon. Thanks again.
Thank you. Dean, you've got about a minute and a half.
Okay, first of all, let me thank our guest for such a great spirited debate. Controversy is terrific, and it always makes for good media. Just in closing, I'd like to say that I'm hearing a phrase in the media that's becoming more and more prevalent. The phrase is cultural acceleration. And the idea here is that something like COVID often accelerates the trends that we were seeing in society. For example, more of us are now buying online. More of us are having Zoom meetings instead of going into the office. What we're seeing here is, in the area of bail and in the area of criminal justice, a part of that cultural acceleration, an evolution that was already developing is now developing even more rapidly. And I think what we're beginning to learn is that there are a lot of people who are sitting in jail, not because they're guilty of anything, but simply because they're poor, or because they're people of color, and eventually, very quickly now, I think we're going to be doing something about that.
Thank you. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. Tonight, we've been talking about your right to bail. Our guests tonight have been the deputy in charge of the South San Francisco branch of the San Mateo County District Attorney's Office, Aaron Fitzgerald, a lifelong Bay Area resident, has been a prosecutor since 2001. Also a practicing attorney, Dean Johnson, an Emmy-nominated legal analyst and commentator, both legal and political matters, for entities including ABC News, NBC News, and Al Jazeera. A former prosecutor, Mr. Johnson practices criminal defense and civil litigation in both state and federal courts. And not to be outdone, in January 1998, Jeff Stanley founded Bad Boys Bail Bonds with a mission to serve the community of San Jose by providing individuals in all stations of life, including low and moderate income families, an avenue to fulfill their Eighth Amendment rights. Bad Boys Bail Bonds now has offices statewide, over 130 employees and 8 additional offices. To each of my guests, Dean Johnson, Aaron Fitzgerald, Jeff Stanley, thank you all for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Your legal rights, your legal rights will be back next week, again at our new time of 6 o'clock, where we'll discuss the surge in the coronavirus pandemic and the effect on public facilities and the inspirational story of what one man could do to affect some change. Thank you all for joining us. To my guest, for Debbie Kennedy at the controls, I'm Jeff Hayden. Our thanks to all of you for listening. Be safe and have a good night.
Thank you.